Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
All right, let me start first with a story that broke on Friday. Just before the show started, this past Friday, the news broke that Patriots owner Robert Kraft was being charged with two counts of soliciting prostitution. Now, at that time, the news was just breaking. The details were hazy. I want to make sure that I laid out, that I reserved judgment, that I did not rush in. I didn't want to overreact to a report or a piece of news. I didn't want to fly off the handle and say something that I would later regret. I wanted to wait until more information came in. So on Friday, when that story broke, right before I went on the air, my gut reaction, my initial reaction was, the hell is that? The hell is that? So, we've had the whole weekend. I had Friday afternoon. I had all of Saturday. I had all of Sunday to think about that story, to come up with a take in reaction to that story. And having had all weekend to sit on this and think about this, my reaction to this whole thing now is, the hell is that? The hell is that? Did that really happen? Did Robert Kraft, the 77-year-old owner of the New England Patriots, really get charged with two counts of soliciting prostitution? Did a 77-year-old billionaire really get caught going to a scummy day spa in a strip mall in Jupiter, Florida? And that if convicted, he could really be facing multiple months in jail. Was this guy really caught as part of a larger sting operation, which involves more than 100 people and allegations of human trafficking? And yes, it led to the headlines like Kraft American Sleaze from the Daily News. Yeah, and how pumped were they about that? Kraft American Sleaze. Also, countless jokes related to Deflategate and a bunch of zany one-liners about Super Bowl rings and prostitution rings. Now, it is worth repeating and reminding everybody that a spokesperson for Kraft said, and I quote, "We categorically deny that Mr. Kraft engaged in any illegal activity. Because it is a judicial matter, we will not be commenting further." All right, that makes sense. Standard operating procedure, SOP. The next time somebody's spokesperson admits that their client's guilty immediately after it goes down, we'll be the first. And then again, you have the police saying that they've got video footage receiving what has been referred to as, quote, paid acts on two separate occasions at that spa. So, someone on one side or the other has got some explaining to do. Either there is video of Kraft, or there isn't. And if he was thinking of arguing that he had no idea that that kind of activity happened at that spa, and he was shocked to learn about it, well, it's kind of hard to make that argument, right? It's kind of hard to make the argument when you go back a second time, allegedly. You know, kind of hard to say, Your Honor, I was going there for a massage. Like, I had this knot in my back, and I had to get it worked out. I had to get it worked on. And then some things happened that, like, you know, I really didn't ask for, and I did not know about. I mean, sure, it ended happily, but I didn't know that was going to happen. And that's not why I went there, Your Honor. Oh, really, old man? Then why did you go back a second time, allegedly? So, what do you do on Saturday if you just got charged with soliciting prostitution on Friday? Well, if you're Bob Kraft, you shake it off. You allegedly hit up a pre-Oscars party. Why the hell not? And according to one timeline, the Palm Beach County State Attorney's Office may officially file charges against Kraft today, which could lead to the creation of a warrant for his arrest, or in the very least, according to WBZ in Boston, a summons sent to Kraft, quote, ordering him to turn himself in. So let me recap the weekend quickly. Friday, accused of soliciting prostitution. Saturday, pre-Oscars party, and potentially Monday, officially charged and summoned to turn yourself in. Have yourself a weekend, Bobby. Hey, Bobbo, I hope that was worth it, and I know it wasn't. Then again, if the timeline provided by the Jupiter Police Chief is accurate, the incidents took place within the last month, which means that in the last month, Robert Kraft watched his team win another Super Bowl and solicited a sex worker at a day spa in a strip mall, not once, but twice. Man, that's a hell of a month. One ring, two happy endings, allegedly. Oh, and as far as that report from Adam Schefter, that Kraft was not the biggest name involved. A spokesperson for the state attorney's office told Deadspin, quote, "Nobody around here has any idea what Schefter's referring to," end quote. Let me tell you about Shefty. I mean, Shefty's got lots of goodwill in the bank. My man is extremely well-respected. However, he did have Condoleezza Rice coaching the Browns. And now this. I mean, who knows? If things don't work out with America's coach, Freddie Kitchens, and you know they will, because he is America's coach. But if for whatever reason they don't work out, maybe she'll still get that job. And maybe there was a bigger name involved in this case than Kraft, although authorities say they have no idea what the hell or who the hell Schefter's talking about. So, I mean, conceivably, it could be two pretty big misses. If, in fact, they're misses. Although, I can't lie. Dude did have my attention for a minute or two. I did spend a minute or two trying to figure out what other billionaire may have directed his chauffeur to a scummy spa in the middle of nowhere in an even worse strip mall for a $59 massage. But back to Kraft. I mean, it's completely insane that Robert Kraft, the man at the top of the greatest dynasty in NFL history, is the guy getting busted for going to a day spa in a strip mall, not once, but twice. I mean, the kind of thing that makes people, or has people making jokes for weeks. As an example, I'm still hearing about Art Modell getting out of the shower and bruising his scrotum. And that happened decades ago. I mean, the clones won't let that go. And yes, people in the area are rushing to that strip mall to take selfies like they were back in the day here in SoCal when they wanted to roll up on OJ's house to get pictures there. But this is really important, really important. There's something much larger at play here. Allegations involving a larger case that are hideous and disgusting. According to Sports Illustrated, quote, "The alleged traffickers are accused of forcing women into sexual servitude at 10 different massage parlors in Orlando, Palm Beach County, and the Treasure Coast, all of which have been shut down. Kraft is one of 25 suspects who allegedly paid for sexual acts by women who had been forced to serve in the parlors," end quote. What I'm saying is this. If you want to come in here and argue that it's just a sad old man looking for something and that we shouldn't punish that between two willing adults, you got to hold that thought for a minute. Because as I mentioned on Friday, according to the Treasure Coast newspapers, police claim, quote, "Women, many of them from China, lived inside the parlor. They were not permitted to leave," end quote. So the allegation is that it's not an activity between two willing adults, but between a client and a woman allegedly being held in the parlor against her will. Now, if that's true, that's hideous. It's disgusting. It's shameful. Man, it's inhumane. It's slavery. If that's true, this destroys the idea that these are two willing adults. That's not somebody soliciting a prostitute. That's somebody soliciting a sex slave. And again, you might ask the question, did he know? How much did he know? What did he know? What did he think? Look, if it's true, this guy's going to be mocked and joked about for years to come. But if there were women in that spa who were held against their will and not allowed to leave, as is alleged, then mocking Kraft will not be nearly enough. Hate to ruin all your fun, clones, but this story is not funny. Unless you happen to find humor in human trafficking and slavery, because that's what this story is about. It's not about some billionaire owner of the Patriots looking to get off in a scummy strip mall. It's not what that's about. If you're like me, you have a mortgage and a family who depends on your income, then you need to protect the ones that you love with life insurance. Life insurance can pay off a mortgage or help send the kids to college. It's peace of mind. You think you can't afford it? Chances are SelectQuote can help you get it for less than a dollar a day. Here's an example. Select Quote could find a 35-year-old man a $500,000 policy for under $19 a month, or a 37-year-old female a $750,000 policy for under $22 a month. A cup of coffee costs more than that. It's going to save you money. It's going to save you time. And yes, you want life insurance. It's important. If you pass, life insurance is your income replacement. It can help your spouse or partner pay off the mortgage or pay for college. Let Select Quote save you time and money. Get your free quote at selectquote.com/Rome right now. That's selectquote.com/Rome. Get a free quote. Do not put off protecting your family even one more day. Selectquote.com/Rome. Get full details on the example policy at selectquote.com/commercials. Your premium could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. Not available in all states. David Sills, and he joins me in studio. David, that's not a bad resume right there. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you for having me.
All right, so you're a few days off from the start of the NFL Combine. How does this week look for you, and what kind of emotions and feelings are you having going into the Combine?
Well, really, from what I've heard, that this week they try to grind you out and really make it a long week and everything. And then on Saturday, they tell you to go out there and put your best tests out on the field. Really, I think a lot of it is mental. You want to go through there and just they want to get you to crack and want to see how you're going to react. So you want to go in there just with a good mindset. And then obviously out there in the field testing, want to go out there and prove some people wrong. I mean, I think a lot of people don't think I'm going to run that fast. I want to go out there and prove that I can stretch the field vertically and be that vertical threat. And then a skinny white kid that, a lot of people don't think I'm very strong. So hopefully go out on the bench press as well and get a good amount of reps there as well.
David Sills joining us. All right, so a lot in that answer that I like. The other day, Dez Bryant tweeted, quote, "Don't sleep on David Sills in the draft. I like his game and attitude. With the right team, he will make some noise early." What was your reaction when you saw that?
Yeah, I mean, I just woke up in the morning and get on Twitter, and a couple of my buddies back from West Virginia were retweeting it. It was pretty cool. I mean, I've never met Dez Bryant. Don't really know him at all. So don't really know how it came up, but obviously he was watching my tape somehow and it was enough to get him to go out of his way and send a tweet out. So don't know if someone was telling him to do that at all, but it's something that's cool, especially coming from a guy like that. I kind of get the red zone, title because of all the touchdowns and everything. And, obviously he was a great, red zone threat. And, when he was playing and everything, it was awesome to see that on Twitter, really, unknown.
All right. So what about that first part of the line? Don't sleep on David Sills. Do you feel like people are sleeping on you?
I feel like it. I feel like what I've been able to do in playing receiver at such a short period of time. I mean, only really playing receiver for the last 2 years and having such a successful college career for those last 2 years. I think people are. I think people are putting a ceiling on me. I think that there's so much upside to my game and being able to, because I'm still learning. I mean, I'm still. I'm continuing to learn the position every day. And I think that gives me an upside that makes me a lot different than a lot of other receivers. And that's kind of where I have a little chip on my shoulder and an edge because I kind of
so you hear that stuff. You're using that stuff as fuel. It motivates you.
I look at it like these guys have been playing this position their whole life. I got to catch up. Like there's something I got to do, and that kind of gives me the edge and gives me the motivation to get up.
How do you do that? How do you close that gap? How do you catch up?
Just outwork them. Continue to close that gap. Continue to get better and continue to. Wake up every day and put more work in the other guys that are at your position.
David Sills joining me in studio. Listen, part of the thing is, like you said, you really have not played the position that long. Now, the last time you were on this show, we talked a little bit about your journey. And for those who don't know, remember, you were offered a scholarship to play quarterback at USC when you were 13. And then you went on to become an all-conference wide receiver at West Virginia. So as you look back on this whole thing, this journey, what kind of thoughts do you have?
It's been a wild journey, for sure. I think a lot of people didn't think, I mean, honestly myself, I didn't think I'd be in this position now. You know, a lot of people were kind of riding me out when I was, you know, when I got the offer in seventh grade. I think a lot of people thought, well, this is just a publicity stunt. You know, this kid really probably won't amount to anything. You know, or if he does, he's probably going to be a head case or something like that. You know, getting this all this exposure at such a young age, nobody thought it was good. You know, and I take it now, I think it prepared me for where I am now. I think, you know, all that obviously was, you know, not the way I thought it was going to go, but eventually, you know, it was always the question, what's more important, playing quarterback or just playing on Sundays? Your dream is to play on Sundays. And, you know, to leave West Virginia for a first time because I wanted to play quarterback and go to a junior college, was tough. You know, that's something that leaving a place where they're not kicking you out at all. It's you're on scholarship, you're comfortable, but you're able to go and say, okay, I want to go follow my dream. And that was something that I was able to go do and you know, go to a junior college and it not work out. And then to have the program come back and call you.
Yeah,
and
but
say,
why did you do that? You had to find out though, right? You went to Elk Mino College. Did you? What was that about? Did you leave?
Everyone says, you know, you should have just stayed for your sophomore year and played receiver. You would have been much better. You would have been a much better receiver if you would have stayed. Your stats would have been better. You would have had more publicity going into your junior year. And my answer to that is more like, I wouldn't have been, because if I would have stayed there at West Virginia, I would have never got quarterback out of my system. I would have woken up 15 years from now saying, you know what, I wish I would have gave it more at quarterback. I didn't give it my all. I still had some, and I would have been, you know, not all the way in at receiver. And that was one thing. I left West Virginia, went and played quarterback at a junior college. You know, I wasn't afraid to fail. Just, you know, I wanted to follow the dream. And when I failed, it was, you know, it failing as in not going back to another school and being able to play quarterback at a high level like I was at West Virginia. You know, that being able to take that and coach calling me back and saying,
let me jump in right there, because it didn't go the way you would hope necessarily, but Dana Holgorsen did call you up. You talked on the phone. What do you remember about that call? What happened?
Well, I remember it probably being his shortest call he's ever had to make to a recruit. We still have that joke kind of going on that he said, come back and play receiver. And, you know, I at that point, I was like considering walking on at other schools. And at this point, it was like, okay, where can I go to play receiver? And he called me and said, come back and play receiver. And I want your, you know, mind completely on receiver. I don't want any of the quarterback stuff, you know, none of that.
What did you say to him?
And I said, absolutely. And I said, I don't need a visit. I don't need anything. Send me the papers. I'll sign them and get them back to you. So
It
was pretty easy.
Hey, listen, he's a really interesting guy, a really interesting coach. What's he like to play for and what makes him so different?
You know, he's an awesome coach. I don't think he comes off to the media as, you know, a player's coach, like that kind of coach, because, you know, of just the way you sometimes see him acting a little crazy on the field and everything. But he really does love his players. You know, we have a great relationship. I talk to him, you know, quite often, even though he's at Houston now. And it was a great time playing for him. And he really does, you know, have a lot of passion for the game. And you can tell how much, you know, winning and everything means to him. But through his players, you know, he makes sure that we're all, you know, set up for the next level as well. You know, so he really was a great head coach for me. And I think he's going to do great things at Houston as well.
David Sill is joining me in studio for another few moments. The chemistry between you and your quarterback, Will Greer, was something special, I think. I mean, you can even see it from the outside looking in. What would you say to any team that's thinking about bringing him in?
Oh, well, he's got a different type of skill set that I think is hard to see if he's not out there in the game. You know, I think, you know, obviously his arm talent, his leadership skills are something you see right off of the bat. But the thing that I think him makes him the most different is when he gets out there in the game. He's a gamer. He's not necessarily a dual threat quarterback, but he figures out how to make things work, you know, when things break down. You know, and I think that's one of the things that separates him from a lot of the other quarterbacks is the way he can improvise and get the ball to his receivers, no matter what's going on in the pocket, what's going on around him. You know, obviously he's got all the other traits, got great arm talent, great accuracy, and great leadership skills. But on the field, you know, he figures out how to get the ball to the receivers, you know, no matter what his position in the pocket is.
So final thought, and you touched on this, but you mentioned you were asked at some point, what's more important, to play quarterback or to play on Sundays? What's it mean to you to now be in a position where you're going to be playing on Sundays?
Yeah, I mean, that was always the goal. It was tough to kind of swallow at first, you know, but this is what I worked for my entire life. You know, I love playing the game. You know, it's something that I genuinely have a passion for. You know, so this next step, you know, going to the combine and then pro day and all that is really just stepping, you know, stepping in the right direction, you know, for fulfilling the ultimate dream that I've had since I was at such a young age.
Sunday's the thing. He's a former wide receiver from West Virginia, an All-American, a Biletnikoff Award finalist, and a two-team first team All-Big 12 player. You've got the draft coming up April 25th through the 27th in Nashville, the combine ahead of that. David Sills joining me in studio. Listen, good to get caught up with you. I'll be tracking that, watching carefully. As soon as you figure out where you're going to live and work, do not big league us. Be sure to come back on the program, and we'll get caught up again. Good luck with it.
Thank you again for having me.
You've got spring training, and the games are underway. But let's be honest, the real drama is still off the field, not on it, because Bryce Harper is still unsigned. And yesterday came reports that Philadelphia was close to finalizing a 10-year deal with Harper. Close to finalizing a 10-year contract, which would make yesterday roughly the 50th consecutive day that the Phillies were on the verge of signing Bryce Harper. Seriously, nobody has ever been closer to being this close to doing something than the Phillies have been to signing Bryce Harper. From the sounds of it, they're just standing on this guy's doorstep with a contract and a pen, waiting for him to come outside and check his mail or pick up a newspaper. Quick, Bryce, sign this. The Phillies have been hours away from finalizing a deal for like a month. Every single day, is this not the report? They're close. They're going to finalize it. However, according to Bob Nightingale, who is plugged in, team owner John Middleton was in Las Vegas, and he was not going to leave until he had a Harper. Until he left without Harper. But the Phillies still feel like they're going to get this thing done. And sooner than later. However, come to find out, the Phillies may not be negotiating against only themselves. Because according to Jeff Passan, the LA Dodgers rolled into Las Vegas, and they are checking out Bryce Harper. Quote, "The Los Angeles Dodgers re-engaged with Bryce Harper's camp 2 weeks ago, seeking a shorter-term deal," sources tell Ramona Shelburne and me. On the heels of Jesse Sanchez's report, the parties met Sunday in Las Vegas. Question becomes whether either side will move toward the other. So you want some more juice to get pumped in this morning. Here's that report from Sanchez. Quote, "Sources, the Dodgers are back in the mix for Bryce Harper. Club officials, including manager Dave Roberts, were seen in Las Vegas on Sunday." So let me pick out a few important details from that tweet. The phrase, "back in the mix." The phrase, "including manager Dave Roberts." I mean, damn. There's no way Dave Roberts is going to Las Vegas if this isn't serious, right? There's no way Dave Roberts is leaving camp and heading to Las Vegas unless there is a legit chance that the Dodgers can come home with Bryce Harper, right? Right? So you know what that means, don't you? Time to start printing up the Harper jerseys. LA may have lost out on Anthony Davis for the time being, but we're going to get Bryce. And yeah, I understand the outfield is not exactly a position of need at that moment. However, when you have a guy like that, when you have one of the all-time great free agents, and notice I'm not saying one of the all-time great players. I'm saying one of the all-time great free agents. Why do I say that? He moves the needle. He puts people in the seats. He's arguably baseball's biggest star, entering his prime. He is a big-time free agent, an all-time free agent. So even if you don't need him and there's not an outfield spot for him, that doesn't mean you don't do that, especially if the DH is going to come to the NL at some point. So if you can add a player, in fact, a star like Harper, that'd be pretty damn sweet, right? That's something you have to look at, right? It might even ease some of those nagging concerns that you have about Clayton Kershaw. Well, and by the way, how you feeling about those reports, Dodger fans? Then again, no time to think about Kershaw putting the ball down for a few days when you've got Bryce Harper bobbleheads to start hyping and a 2019 World Series parade to start planning. Now, let's just read one more tweet from Passan and then decide whether the parade should just go back and forth on Figueroa or if they should start on Fig and then take a right and head all the way to the ocean. Here is the other part of the tweet from Passan. Quote, from the start, Bryce Harper has sought a decade-long plus deal. There is no indication, sources said, that has changed. The Dodgers, meanwhile, have long been opposed to very long-term deals. Still, the Dodgers' emergence has thrown a fascinating wrench into these negotiations. All right, so the Dodgers' emergence has thrown a fascinating wrench into those negotiations. And that particular tweet throws a fascinating wet blanket over Dodger fans. Because what I'm saying is, unless something has changed really dramatically, nothing has changed. For this to be real, for Harper to be a Dodger, either he has to decide that he does not want a long-term deal, or the Dodgers have to decide they're willing to do a long-term deal. And that would be a huge change for both of them to make. And does anybody really think either of those things is going to happen? Do you really think that Bryce Harper and Scott Boras worked this hard to get into position for this deal, the highest in baseball history, only for Harper to decide at the last second, damn, I like L.A., I like the West Coast. Yeah, that's not important to me all of a sudden. I don't need the security of a long-term deal. I don't need to be the highest paid guy ever. No, man. I love L.A. Yeah, for sure I'll do that. Yeah, I understand the lure of the big market. I understand that he may even have some reservations about Philadelphia. But how much is that lure worth? How much are those reservations worth? Do you really think Scott Boras would encourage a move like that, much less Harper doing something like that? Is he really going to walk away from an alleged 10-year deal on the table in Philly to take less and fewer years in L.A.? And are the Dodgers really going to change their whole philosophy about long-term deals to sign a guy at a position where they really don't have a need? Is it real, or is it all just a ploy from Boras and Harper to jam Philly to get more jack out of them? To get Philly from being close to signing Bryce to actually finally signing Bryce? And don't get me wrong, Bryce would be good for L.A. L.A. would be good for Bryce. But is either one going to budge enough to make that happen? If I'm the Dodgers, I get on that plane and I do everything I can to talk Bryce into it. And my man Dave Roberts is as good as they come. But does anybody anywhere think that Harper and Boras are going to leave a nickel on the table, much less multiple years and multiple millions? Yet neither do I. Either way, just get it done. Get it done. Get it done. Get it done so we can move on to the next thing. And then waste all of our time trying to figure out where Craig Kimbrel and Dallas Keuchel are going to live and work. Can we move on to the next thing? It is a fascinating wrench. But you know what would be a really fascinating wrench? Is if the guy left a nickel on the table. And a year, much less three or four or five. What about that Clayton Kershaw thing? Yeah, I know that they said he does not need an MRI. I know that they said he is still their opening day starter. It's a little weird that he's taking time off right now. That he's put the ball down for a few days. I'm not there. I don't know. But given the mileage he has, given how old he is, given the loss to Velo, and given the fact that he's already resting, hey, hopefully it's just one of those spring training things. You know, Clayton, he's not going to tell you anything. He's just going to cowboy up, work through it. But they're working awfully hard to say to you, he does not need an MRI. He is still our opening day starter. They need this guy now. They need him to kind of evolve and become that next stage or next level kind of pitcher that he is, because he's not going to be the guy he used to be. We know this. And I think that Dave Roberts would argue, even if he were to cop to that, Dave Roberts would say, yeah, maybe not. Maybe not, but guys do evolve. Guys do change. He's still an elite pitcher. Maybe they got to kind of accept what he is. Better yet, maybe he needs to kind of accept what he is. I know that Clayton came into spring training and in the offseason was talking about doing work to get back that velocity lost. So I'd be kind of concerned about the fact that he hasn't picked up the ball for a few days. But they say they're not. Bryce Harper, is he going to be in Philadelphia or not? Do you like that fit in Philadelphia or not? And a lot of times it's not about fit. You know what it's about? Cash. Cash. I don't care about the fit. Cash. If that guy's looking at $301 million, if that guy's looking at $325 million, does fit really matter? Who's going to leave that money on the table? Because, yeah, I'm a little concerned about that fit. Trust me, for $325, the fit's right. Ask any athlete in the history of the world. Bucky Brooks is my guest. Bucky, great to have you back. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Always good to have you. Let me jump right into it. Let me start a quarterback with you. You recently tweeted that Dwayne Haskins is the number one quarterback in this year's class. What have you seen from him that makes you say that?
Oh, he's a fantastic player, Jim. When you watch him play, he plays the game the way that the top quarterbacks have played in the league for the last 20 to 30 years. He is an outstanding pocket passer. He has a big arm. He can make every throw that you want to see, but he also can throw with finesse. He can throw with touch, timing, and anticipation. He has a high football IQ, and he is a guy that, despite only playing 1 year as a starter, this guy put up remarkable numbers, 50 touchdowns, only 8 interceptions, plays the game the right way. I think for most teams who want to have a pocket passer, someone that can kind of play it in a very traditional fashion, Dwayne Haskins is the guy that checks off all the boxes. And it'd be interesting to see, after he spends it at the combine, what the conversation is coming out of Indy prior to opposed to what it was going into Indianapolis.
Bucky Brooks joining us. You know, one more thought about that. When you watch him, what do you make of the way he handles things when the protection breaks down? Do you like that from him?
No, you know, there's a lot of people that talk about, like, look, he's not a mobile guy. He doesn't have the athleticism. But I think the maker of the elite quarterbacks understand what's coming, and they figure out a way to get rid of the ball. And I'm not saying that this kid is going to come in and automatically be Tom Brady or Peyton Manning. But when you see how Tom Brady and Peyton Manning were able to evolve their games later in their careers, it's because they understood how the defense was attacking, and they were able to answer it by getting the ball out quickly into the hands of the playmakers. I think Dwayne Haskins in time is going to be that kind of player. He is going to be a guy that dissects the defense during the pre-snap phase and absolutely picks apart defenses once the ball is snapped, because he understands exactly where to go to the ball, go with the ball, and he does it in spectacular fashion.
Bucky Brooks, NFL media analyst, also played and scouted in the NFL for a number of years. Bucky, then, of course, there is Kyler Murray. What is the biggest question about him that you're looking to have answered at the combine?
I mean, the biggest question everyone's going to have is, what does he measure in at? Like, how tall is he? How much does he weigh? We saw Peter King reported that he was 206 pounds the most recent time that he had been weighed. Whether he comes in at 5'10 or a shade under 5'10, he is what he is. But what I can tell you is, when I pop in the tape, you won't find many football players that are better than him. What he does with the ball in his hands is dynamic. He's explosive. He can win inside or outside the pocket. He is a guy that, look, when you look at his numbers compared to Baker Mayfield's numbers at Oklahoma in the same system with the same coach, the numbers are comparable, but Kyler Murray gives you a little more explosiveness as a runner. Based on how Baker Mayfield played his first year in the league, I think there's something to say that, look, Kyler Murray can come in the league, and in the right system with the right coach, he can absolutely light it up. But you have to be willing to kind of build your offense around what he's able to do.
We're talking to Bucky Brooks. Bucky, you know how front offices work. So do you think teams will look at Murray and see the potential and the types of things you're talking about right here? Or are they going to look and see the concerns and not want to take that risk?
I mean, I think ultimately it depends on how comfortable you are in your situation. A long-tenured general manager who has a lot of pelts on the wall, he could take a Kyler Murray and know that if Kyler Murray doesn't work out, it won't necessarily affect or impact his reputation as an evaluator. The thing that general managers like to do is they want to make sure that they don't mess it up, that they just kind of hit it down the fairway, that they don't take necessarily risks. And the best way to do it is to go after guys who check off all the boxes when it comes to the prototypes. He's not a prototypical quarterback, but what he is an excellent quarterback. And if you match him up, he and Dwayne Haskins versus some of the other guys in the class, if you just look at the tape, Kyler Murray outplays all of them. And I think the conversation is, who would you prefer first, Kyler Murray or Dwayne Haskins? Because it's not a debate with the other guys in my mind.
How about you, Bucky? When you look at those two guys, I understand they're very different players, but who would you rather have first if that were your pick?
You know, it's tough because depending upon the offense, if I'm the Arizona Cardinals and say I was looking for a quarterback, Kyler Murray would be the guy because Cliff Kingsbury has had experience with those kind of quarterbacks, and he said he would take him number one. But if you ask me for the overwhelming majority of teams, I would take Dwayne Haskins. I think Dwayne Haskins is the classic prototypical quarterback that most teams covet. I don't understand why the conversation hasn't been about him being a terrific prospect and maybe one of the best prospects that we've seen in the position. But I will tell you, I think the kid is special, and I think he's going to do special things in the league.
So, Buck, if you were the Cardinals and you had Josh Rosen, would you feel like we already have our franchise quarterback, or is Murray so special that he's too special to pass up, even if you've got Rosen?
I think it would be a situation where Murray's too special in the scheme that they're going to use under Cliff Kingsbury to pass up. Look, I think this kid is a remarkable player. Obviously, he won the Heisman Trophy, and you saw the numbers that he was able to put up. But there are people that will tell you going all the way back to high school that he may have been the best high school football player in the state of Texas based on what he was able to do as a three-time state champion at Allen High School. This kid is good. And when he dedicates himself to being a football player full-time, which is what he will do going forward, I think the ceiling is tremendous. I think he has an opportunity to really be a star in the league.
Bucky Brooks joining us. Now, taking a step back and looking at the combine overall, you and Daniel Jeremiah, Bucky, had a really interesting conversation on your podcast about technology and the combine. You know, as you take that step back, what kind of role can you see technology playing in the combine in the coming years?
It's going to continue to play a huge role in the way that guys are scouting these prospects. And I know we're kind of old school in the way that we compile the numbers. We do 40 times and short shuttles and verticals and all those things. And traditionally, we've done those things on stopwatches. Well, with the GPS technology that is now available, you can track and monitor how explosive guys are. You can do things when you're compiling data for the prototypes that are succeeding in the league when it comes to measuring that data. I just think as we continue to get comfortable with the analytics and the metrics and the data that is now available, they're really good football minds are going to be able to find ways to bridge that information with the intel of scouting and looking at tape and find a way to really narrow the focus when it comes to the really good players that are in each draft.
We are talking to Bucky Brooks. I've got a couple of quick things for you, Bucky, before I let you go that I really am curious about. Your colleague Maurice Jones-Drew asked you if the Steelers will have a winning season next year without Le'Veon Bell and Antonio Brown. I mean, talent is a key, obviously, to success in the NFL, but so is having chemistry and making the pieces fit together. How do you see that offense next year without the two of them?
A lot of it depends on Ben Roethlisberger and his ability to step back and allow the Steelers to play the best way that they need to play to win games. Meaning, without A.B. and without Le'Veon Bell, this is a team that may not be as explosive or as dynamic as it has been the last 4 or 5 years. Will Ben Roethlisberger be willing to check his ego at the door and play like maybe the Patriots had to play when they decided at the end of the year that the best way for them to win was to run the ball, play a little more ball control, and kind of shrink the game by running and salting the game away? If Roethlisberger is willing to do that, then they certainly can win games. But I think this is really kind of a critical situation, not for the players, but for Mike Tomlin. Mike Tomlin has an opportunity to regain control of his locker room. This could be the reset that the Seattle Seahawks were able to do last year under Pete Carroll. Will Mike Tomlin orchestrate that kind of reset where he blows out A.B., he knows that Le'Veon Bell is not going to be there, he takes the reins back from Ben Roethlisberger, and he says, this is how the Steelers are going to play. This is my team. and I'm going to put my thumbprint on this team. We'll see if he's willing to do that.
Hey, Bucky, it makes sense, right? But then you had the GM saying last week that Ben Roethlisberger was more than right to call out his teammates, that if they were smart, the, quote, 52 kids that Ben has to play with should be looking at Ben because he's the one with the rings. So do you think Tomlin will try to rip that control back to Ben? Or what's going on when the GM is saying Ben's got it right, actually?
You know, Ben has ultimately gotten the pass. And I know people come at me because they say I always give Ben a hard time. But I think when you look at the quarterbacks that are the ultimate leaders and winners in this league, they're the ones that kind of understand when they need to be selfless, when they need to make sure that they put more on them when it comes to taking the blame. They also know how to elevate their players, not only through playing, but through the way that they lead. I think the thing with Ben Roethlisberger, everyone wants to see on your chest, but are you willing to do the things that really make you a captain? Are you willing to privately instruct those guys and elevate them while publicly continue to praise them? You don't criticize people in an open forum. Leadership is not how you do it in the presser. Leadership is what you really do to help your teammates become better players. I don't know if he has that in him, but if he wants to accomplish these things that he says that he wants in terms of being a champion, he is going to have to think about changing his leadership style, because the way that he's doing it now certainly doesn't endear him to his peers.
Bucky, you sound like a coach, and the reason for that is you are a coach. I mentioned it off the very top. You are the new head football coach at Granada Hills Charter High School. I think that's absolutely awesome. Given how busy you are with your media career and everything else you have going on, why was that something that was so important to you, and how excited are you to do this job?
Hey, I'm really excited about it. I've been coaching in the L.A. area for 10 years. That's been 10 years at Notre Dame High School in Sherman Oaks. I think it's best known for Justin Fargus played there. And so I had an opportunity to play, to coach there. I was offensive coordinator last year, but I've always had a desire to be a high school coach. My dad is a high school coach. My high school coach in North Carolina is probably one of the best to ever do it in North Carolina. So I always wanted to see if their recipes and their formulas will work at the high school level. Plus, being around so many great coaches in the National Football League, from Tom Coughlin to Marv Levy, Mike Holmgren, John Gruden, Marty Schottenheimer, I want to see if some of those things that I learned from those guys would work on the high school level while also having an opportunity to really shape and influence and develop young people. It's a terrific opportunity to go back to John Elway's high school and see if we can orchestrate a little change and see if we can do some things that would be great in the city.
Hey, Bucky, I absolutely love this thing, and I know the schools you're talking about. I love that you're taking this on, but I'm blown away that you're doing it in the 818. I'm from the 818. I wonder when you're going to work your way back to my alma mater, Calabasas High School.
Well, one of my best friends is coaching at Calabasas, Chris Claiborne. He's the head coach there. He's done a terrific job of kind of elevating that program. And so I may not be able to get to your old program, but it's in good hands with my guy, Chris Claiborne. I'm hoping that we can kind of create our own legacy at Granada Hills, and we can make John Elway and some of the other guys that have been Highlanders proud.
Hey, Bucky, I know you got your own thing going, but just really quickly about Claiborne, you're right. I mean, I know that he's the guy there right now. Understand that when I went there, we were not real proud of the football program. It's amazing what he has done. How did a guy like that see possibility at a school where there really had never been any kind of success before? Why would he go there and do that?
Well, you know, like, I think the thing, and really, in all fairness, I'm going to give credit to Rick and Casey Clawson, because they really took it to one level and elevated it. Chris has gone in, and we all, as former players, like, we all love the game. And coaching is the ultimate give back. And then when Chris and I have talked, we've talked about trying to show young people how to do it the right way, trying to build a program the right way. We all are in it to kind of scratch the competitive itch. But we also are trying to live vicariously through our players. The closest thing to playing is coaching. And so when you see young people accomplish certain things on the field and away from the field, it makes you feel proud. I think Chris and I share the same vision. And I think for both of our respective programs, we would like to see those programs elevated and respected and kind of talked about when our time comes and goes.
Right, so really quickly, you know the NBA season is taking a pretty dramatic turn. If I'm talking about a beef between Ja Rule and the Minnesota T-Wolves. Not just a Twitter spat, but one that includes a curse. And I don't mean like profanity. I don't mean like a curse word. I mean an actual curse. Like somebody dropped a hex on somebody. Yeah, I'm talking about Ja Rule putting a curse on the T-Wolves. And if I'm being honest, I never thought that I'd ever be talking about that. But here we are. Here the bleep we are. Now, as you know, Ja Rule has been getting a lot of ink recently, given that there has been not one, but two different docs on the sham that was the Fyre Festival and his role in that. And it was all that heat that inspired him to jump on Twitter last month with this classic tweet, quote, "I too was hustled, scammed, bamboozled, hoodwinked, led astray." Hey, listen, you know how this goes. If you don't like what people are saying about you, man, run a misdirection. Change the story. Change the narrative. Get them to talk about something else. So that's what he attempted to do by showing up at Saturday's T-Wolves Bucks game in Milwaukee to perform at halftime. Now, the Bucks were paying tribute to the 90s, and they did so by inviting a guy who was actually better known for his work in the 2000s. At least that's what he pointed out. But he soldiered on. He threw on a Ray Allen throwback jersey, and he got the crowd fired up. Go ahead and roll this.
They said this is 90s night. So they brought out a 2000 artist. But my album came out in 99, so I guess that counts. Sanchez, we ready? 1 second. I'm rolling up. Are we ready? I guess not. All right. Turn me up. Turn me up. Milwaukee!
In a word, awkward?
Awkward.
It's an amazing clip. Like, I'm not going to get into the semantics of having a guy whose album came out in 1999 on a 90s night and saying that he's more of a 2000s guy. Nor am I going to get on Ja Rule for trying to make him sound like a more recent artist who shouldn't have even been messing around with the 90s night. Let's focus on what matters. My man's laugh. Dude, that's an amazing laugh. Alvin, go ahead and add that to your list of all-time great laughs. Can I get that list really quickly? Alvin. You know what was funny? You know what I thought was funny? The look you just shot me when I said, could I get that list? Dude, was that so hard, Alvin? Even more amazing is that he chases that with Sanchez, are we ready? And it's not totally clear what Sanchez says or who Sanchez is, but it sure as hell did not sound like the Sanchez there was ready. Because the next thing we hear is, are we ready?
Are we ready?
Followed by dead silence. And then, I guess not.
I guess not.
That, excuse me, my bad.
MMA
announcer cannot believe the record scratch on that. Nothing like screaming, are we ready? For like a full minute and then getting nothing. I actually feel for this cat. That'd be like, hey, Alvin, are we ready?
Are we ready?
And Alvin giving me that terrified look. Hey, listen, I'm not going to crush a guy for the stone silence that greeted the, are we ready?
Are we ready?
For all we know, the crowd was going crazy and somebody did not turn the mic up. Or not. Either way, Ja Rule, being the pro that he is, worked through it and then just kept grinding, kept working. Because according to reports, his performance went so long and was so bad, the Greek Freak was out on the court getting shots up, warming up for the third quarter while Ja Rule was still out there performing. I mean, for a guy who had a hit that was always on time, it sure seems like that was not the case. Hell! In other words, pretty much nothing went right, which led the T-Wolves to tweet a photo of Ja Rule's performance with the caption, quote, "We too were hustled, scammed, bamboozled, hoodwinked, and led astray." I mean, bam, that is so badass. And that was not the only criticism that Rule was taking on Twitter. And you know what he's going to do in a situation like that? The thing that he should not do. jump on Twitter. There was this rather profane tweet directed at all the haters. Quote, y'all really be on my bleep. Let's be clear. My sound was bleeped up at first and didn't come on when it was supposed to, but I rocked that bleep. Thanks for the love, Milwaukee. Great win. My streak continues. LOL.
Laugh out loud.
Then there was this one in response to Bleacher Report's tweet with video of Giannis warming up during the show. He said, quote, y'all act like this is not normal at halftime shows. Y'all mad corny for this post. And then there was this heat for the T-Wolves for having the audacity to mock him. Quote, you just jinx yourself talking to the god this way. You curse now. You won't win a championship for the next 30 years. And Kat is leaving. Apologize and I'll lift the curse. Kiss of death. Damn rule. Don't hurt the T-Wolves that way. Let me break this down really quickly, line by line. I love that his immediate reaction to a team talking junk to him is to bash them for, quote, talking to the god this way, end quote. And then chasing that with, your curse now. And then here comes the curse. You won't win a championship for the next 30 years, and Kat's leaving. All right, first off, the T-Wolves haven't won a championship in their first 30 years. Saying that they won't win one in their next 30 isn't exactly a curse. Man, it's a freaking prediction, and a really good prediction. It's like a lock. And as for Kat leaving, my man agreed to a 5-year extension back in September. So it doesn't mean that he's not eventually going to leave, but it's not like he's going to bolt tomorrow because Ja Rule was ticked off about the team's official Twitter account getting on him about the halftime show. Oh, and as for that apologize and I'll lift the curse part, yeah, I'm still waiting for the T-Wolves to apologize because they just kept right on tweeting about the game and then they posted photoshops of fake movie posters in honor of the Oscars. Ja Rule, I know that did not go the way that you would have liked and you took some heat for it. Man, but don't jump on Twitter and start banging out weird curses. Do what the greats do. Man, just roll with it and laugh it off. Just laugh it off. Tom Thibodeau would have laughed that off for sure. I'm joined in studio right now by Michael Badgley. Michael, my man, it is so good to see you. How are you?
All right, I'm great. Thank you for having me. This is great. Big fan of the show. Love it.
All right, it's good to have you. So did you bring me a gift here? What's going on?
Yeah, brought you a little Money Badger t-shirt.
The Money Badger. Oh, yeah. Money Badger is one of my all-time favorite nicknames. For those who don't know, where did that come from?
One day I was just hanging out in the locker room. One of the reporters came up to me and said, hey, these fans are tweeting out, you know, the Money Badger this, Money Badger that. Do you like the nickname? And I go, well, I'm not going to make up my own nickname. So yeah, sure. Let's run with it.
Hey, you know better than to self-gloss. Money Badger is great. What do you like better, Money Badger or Money Bags?
Oh, in the locker room, Melvin Gordon kind of started throwing the name Money Bags out there. So I think he likes it. Both are great nicknames. I love it. So
they're both great. If you ask me, I'm going to go with the Money Badger. Listen, it's kind of funny and something to laugh at, but the fact that you've got guys like vets, quality guys in that locker room, and they're hitting you with handles like Money Badger and Money Bags for a team that has been searching for a kicker, what does that respect mean to you? How does that feel?
It's incredible. You know, you walk into the room, you're kind of like a ghost. Everyone's looking at you kind of like, oh, you know, just another kicker in the room. You're walking by Phillip Rivers, Antonio Gates, guys like that, and you're not sure what, you know, what's really going on when you're walking through that locker room. But to have their respect and to, you know, be able to talk to them on the plane rides or on the sideline, it's incredible.
Well, initially, was that the vibe? I mean, not anymore, never again, but was the vibe initially great? Here comes another kicker. I wonder how long this guy's going to last.
I mean, maybe for them, you know, I got my own goals, so I kind of was like, nah, I'm going to take this role and run with it. But yeah, I think with this organization, there was probably some of that going through the locker room, and they just wanted a guy they could trust.
Michael Badgley joining me in studio. So I had West Virginia wide receiver David Sills in the studio earlier this show. We were talking about the prep for the combine and the NFL draft. Take me back to this time last year. You're coming off a record-breaking career at Miami. What kind of thoughts were you having about the NFL? And then how were you preparing for life after college?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of expectations going through that whole process because the season ends and you're going through everything. You got the Senior Bowl coming up. And then after that, you got the combine prep. And then after that, you got pro day. So everything's just building up to different stressful situations, and you're not sure how you're going to react. especially being a kicker, you know, what kind of training are you going to do? What are you going to do?
What's that like? I was going to say, prepping as a kicker is a little bit different than any other position. So how'd you go about prepping? Like, what's a kicker do to get ready for all these things?
I just tried to stay an athlete, you know, because my whole life, that's just what I've based myself on, playing three sports and, you know, doing that kind of workout stuff and just, you know, trying to have the beach body and look good.
See, but, people have to understand this. I don't know if they appreciate where you're coming from on this, but I want to follow you up really quickly right there. You know, this whole notion that kickers are not that athletic. Fact is, set the record straight. Is it true that you played ball at Summit High School in New Jersey, that you were a quarterback, a running back, a receiver, a free safety, a kicker, a kick returner, and a punt returner?
Yeah, I didn't like leaving the field. I didn't leave. I'd score a touchdown, kick the extra point, do the kickoff, go back, play safety on defense, and then same thing. If they had to go punt returner, I was kick returner too. It was fun.
All right, so there's a story that your senior year of high school, the starting quarterback goes down, so you played some quarterback. 7 of your completions went for TDs. Is that true? And what were you like spinning it out there?
You know, at first, when I would go in at quarterback, I was just a guy who kind of knew the whole offense, so they wanted a guy who was running the show back there like that. And they didn't think I could really throw until I went up to coach, and I go, you got to give me a chance here. These guys aren't going to be able to cover our guys. So we ran like this play action play, and I just threw it deep to my buddy downfield, and it just set off. Yeah, I can throw. So they
what'd the coach say?
He was like, "All right, we're gonna start throwing the ball a little bit." But my first pass was a pop pass across the middle against Cranford, threw an interception. So that kind of didn't start off on the right foot. But
not when you're telling him you can do it.
As soon as we went deep, it was cool.
All right. So the legend of the Money Badger is even bigger than that. True or false? Did you win state titles in football, hockey, and lacrosse, and was the plan for you to play lacrosse in college?
Yeah. You know, in my town, lacrosse was what everybody did. You know, everyone would go play Division I lacrosse. So I'm thinking, all right, I guess that's what I got to do. My brother did it. He went to Providence College. He was a goalie. So all through high school, I was like, all right, I'm going to go play lacrosse. But then one day, my high school coach came up to me and said, hey, you know, you're pretty good at this kicking thing. You should take a look into doing it. You're getting some looks. So I started getting some looks, and you know, I love football, so that was a no-brainer for me to do that.
All right, dude, so you're like a freaky athlete. You're the Money Badger. You go to Miami, and you have this great career. You're getting ready for the combines and everything that comes along with it. What kind of interest were you getting from NFL teams at that point?
You know, you hear different things. Your agent's telling you some things. You're not sure what's going on, what teams need. You're breaking down other teams and what they need, if they need a kicker, what their other seasons were like, if they're going to re-sign the guy. But you know, when push comes to shove at the end of it, you know, you're expecting to get drafted, and then that day comes and you don't, then you try to, you're like, okay, let's go free agency and see what teams are calling. Not a lot of teams were calling. And luckily the Indianapolis Colts gave me a chance, and I said, all right, let's go hang out with Adam Vinatieri. See what that brings.
That's something totally different too. Okay. But when you were undrafted, I mean, what was that? Did that feel, and you're a confident guy, but did that feel like a slap in the face? Did it feel like you were disrespected? Did it hurt your confidence? Like, what did you do with that?
You know, like I said, everyone's got their goals and expectations. So, yeah, I wanted to get drafted, and I thought I would be. But at the end of the day, you know, being the undrafted guy, I kind of felt like I got more of a chip on my shoulder. So I was excited, and I knew that any opportunity I was going to get, I was going to embrace it.
So you go to the Colts, right? So you go to compete with the greatest guy to ever do it. What was that like? Was that, okay, you have goals. You're a competitive guy. Were you thinking, I respect this guy. I love this guy. I'm coming for his job. I'm going to beat this guy out.
Well, I think at the end of the day, you know what's going to happen, especially in an organization like that with a guy who's got so much respect throughout the NFL. But, you know, my mentality didn't change. I was going in there to try to beat the guy. But you know, I also took that opportunity to learn as much as I could from a guy like that. You know, the mental side of the game, how to walk around a locker room, just how to be a pro. So it was little things like that that I knew I wanted to take away from that whole experience.
I can say, look, I've spent a lot of time with a lot of guys, and when Vinatieri walks up, he's got a presence to him now. Like, know, like this guy's got a lot of respect from a lot of different people, and I don't care what the position is. What was your biggest takeaway from the time you spent with him and the chat you had with him?
Just a lot of the talks we had, he's got a lot of great stories. His mental edge is totally different, you know, and the thing a lot of people ask is, oh, did you learn anything from, you know, the way he kicks? And I go, you know, every kicker's got their own style, their own swagger to him. So learning different ways to kick the ball from him wasn't a thing, but I learned how to be a pro, you know, how to be around the guys in the locker room and just, you know, be part of the team. Cause a lot of times you see specialists, they're just kind of on their own. They're just off to the side and just like, okay,
how do you
that guy's just
that? I mean, do you want to be one of the fellas and say, hey, look, man, I'm part of this team. I'm with you guys. Or do you stay off to the side and do your own thing?
No question. You know, I'm a football player. That's the way I look at it. So, you know, whether it's talking to the guys on the plane rides home or being in the locker room and, you know, chopping it up about sports and everything, just, you know, be a football player.
So when you talk about kicker swag, like, what's your kicker swag? What does kicker swag look like?
Basically just having a team that has confidence in you when you walk out there. Being able to tell the coach, hey, I can make this. You know, when he asks you, he's got no question in his brain that he's going to let you go out there and kick a 53-yard field goal in a playoff game. So it's certain things like that, just being able to walk on the field and have confidence that...
God, dude, what's that like? Everybody wants to know what that's like. What's it like to line up and look at a 53-yarder in a postseason game to win a football game? I mean, are you the only guy on the planet? What's it feel like?
It's one of those experiences where you've worked on it in practice, so it's kind of natural... So, you know, kickers and, you know, guys like me, when you walk out there, but to the outsider's edge, I guess it's like, wow, you know, that's pretty far. But, you know, 53 in a playoff game, you got to get the points you can. So being able to go out there and to be able to make a kick like that was awesome.
So not making a kick like that probably feels like the worst thing in the world, even though that's part of the job. Does making it feel like the greatest thing in the world, or is it just relief?
More so just I got my job done. Especially
your
that
job.
Play. As a kicker, you only get so many plays. You know, D lineman can miss a tackle, they get the next play to go out there and do it. As a kicker, you might not get another kick. So it's one of those things where, all right, I got only so many opportunities, got to make the most of them.
Dude, you sound like you're wired for it. I mean, how much mental training goes into it? I mean, is that a muscle you constantly work, or are you just kind of wired for it, man? Like, you want that moment. You're not afraid of the moment.
Yeah, you got to embrace stuff like that. You got to want the pressure. You know, certain things, and, you know, you got to know that there's going to be misses. You know, there's going to be times where, you know, you're the guy that, you know, ruins the season, or you don't want it to be, but you're going to be the guy that misses a kick. But to get over those situations is what kind of makes and breaks you. So it's I love the pressure of it.
In the back of your mind, like Scott Norwood, like this guy missed a 47-yarder in the Super Bowl. Dude, that's no chip shot, man. That's a 47-yard kick. And then that just kind of sticks to that guy.
Yeah.
Fair or not fair? Is that in the back of your mind that could be me one day?
You know, you don't think about those kind of things.
I wouldn't either, man.
Yeah, no. You don't think about stuff that's happened in the past. You just kind of take the moment, go out there, and, you know, that feeling just... Let me do my job here and let me embrace this. It's awesome.
Michael Badgley joining us, and you have. So you get the opportunity with the Chargers. I know you had a connection with the staff, which I'll get to if I have time, but what was a kicking tryout with that team like?
It was awesome. There was three of us out there. You know, there's only so many opportunities that you get, because I had one with the Raiders a week before or 2 weeks before, something like that, and I guess it didn't go my way, and then I get that call with the Chargers, and I was like, I'm gonna go out there. I'm going to do my thing. So I knew that opportunity, I had to embrace it. So it's one of those, you know, your adrenaline's pumping, but as soon as you let that first kick fly, you're like, all right, let's let it roll here.
Can you slow down the adrenaline? How do you do that? Like, I know for, like, what I do, if there's a big stakes opportunity, man, it just starts pumping. And I've always tried to figure out, how do you slow that down? Can you?
I think you develop a confidence when you kind of start running out into the field and you realize it's not a nervous situation anymore. You know, I go back to college, I think my sophomore year was my first game winner attempt against Nebraska. It was only a 28-yarder. But I remember I was shaking. I was like, oh, this is it. Like, this is a chance to be the hero. And I was shaking, and luckily I made it. But ever since that point, I was able to run on the field just to, you know, just be cool, calm, and relaxed, and just have fun with it.
And then your first game against the Browns, you make all your kicks. What was that game like?
Oh, that was awesome. I mean, that environment alone, being away for your first game and packed stadium like that, it was intense. And I just knew, all right, get that first extra point through, and then, all right, let's roll.
Michael Badgley joining me for another few moments. And then against the Steelers, you're lining up to kick the game winner in Pittsburgh. All right, hostile environment. The kick was missed. Joe Hayden jumped off sides. You get another look. They jump off sides again, and then you nail the third one to win that game. What do you remember about that sequence?
It was incredible. I've always told myself, you know, just make the first one. Then nobody's saying anything. Nobody cares. Just bury that first one. But then they come. They jump off sides. They block it. I'm like, all right, we got another shot here. And then you get closer, and then I'm like, all right, I'm going to make this one. Third time's a charm. Buried it. Let's go home. Let's get out of there. Especially in a game like that. We came back. Sunday night football. Al Michaels, Chris Collinsworth. It was special.
Man, dude, what's that flight home like after a game like that and a win like that?
You know, like I said, those plane rides home, and I was lucky enough, besides the flight home from New England, every single flight home was, you know, a happy ending. You know, we were fired up. It was never a loss on one of those flights home. So it was always a great time. Everybody's in a good mood. Philip Rivers is telling us stories. It was awesome.
That's what it's all about, right? And then the flip side of that, unfortunately, what's the plane flight home like after New England? No one's telling any stories.
Yeah, you know, especially a flight like that, the season's over. So you kind of, everyone's alone. They're sitting down, they're remorseful, they're watching film, what they could have done better. But once those long flights get going, then everyone kind of starts chattering up a little bit, and you talk about the seasons, the good times.
That's the beer, bro, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's the liquid. So finally, you have that monster game against the Ravens in the playoffs. You're coming into a season now where you went from being undrafted and waived in Indianapolis to setting franchise records for the Chargers. They're making shirts. You're the money badger. How does it all feel now?
It's cool. You know, to kind of take off like this, it's awesome. And it's cool to run with a brand like this and, you know, have so many people supporting me, all the fans and, you know, this whole city of L.A. But, you know, I've always said just one kick at a time. Just keep going like that. Keep the same motive that's gotten me here. And just, one day at a time. One kick at a time.
Is that personal consumption right there, or is there an online store? Can people get those things?
Oh, yeah. You go to MikeMoneyBadger.com. Also, link in my bio on Michael Badgie on Instagram.
Good night!